So before we meditate, we usually do some question and answers or a little bit of Dharma talk. So I was wondering if anyone has anything on their mind that they'd like to talk about or hear something about.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit how the mala fits into meditation, or does it?
The mala? Well, it is actually is a kind of meditation. It's a very light form of meditation that you can do while you're doing other things. It's just repeating a mantra with each beat, and then usually also keeping count of the number of cycles. I don't have one on my mala, but very often there will be two strings, and each time you go all the way around, you advance one string, one beat, and then when that string has gotten around all the way to the other side, then you advance the second string, one beat, and start over. And in this way, you can accumulate a large number of repetitions. As a matter of fact, in the Kagyu tradition, you would be expected to do this in batches of 108,000 repetitions of the mantra. So in order to do that, you end up carrying a mala around with you, and every time there's, a time that you can do it, or sometimes just to sit and relax and be fully present and do the mala. So it is a light form of meditation that just helps to get your mind in the habit of maintaining a certain level of attention and awareness. Some people attribute significance to it in the form of the power that the mantra that you repeat has and so forth, but I'll leave that to people who think of it that way to go into.
I think it's very useful to clear your mind of other thoughts, if you just kind of puts you into an altered space of.
If you do only the mantras, yes. But if you'll notice the way most people do it when they use a mala is they'll be using the mala while their mind is also occupied with other things. So, but even in that, it still does serve to help anchor your attention somewhat and gives you a little more awareness. If you're sitting there counting beads in a mala and you're listening to somebody and you start to feel angry, then it's kind of a reminder that, well, wait a minute, why am I reacting this way? I'm doing two different things at the same time that are completely incompatible with each other.
I found it very useful sometimes in doing a walking meditation and using and saying the mantras at the same time to sort of get me into this space of the repetition and the mantras not having any particular meaning that I know of, just the syllables, just saying the syllables over and over again.
There's not room for other things to come in that way.
Right.
Yeah.
It sort of
to distract
occupies your mind so that you're not don't start thinking about what you're going to do next or what
yeah.
Yeah.
You'll find in Buddhist countries that devout lay people often carry a mala with them and all kinds of different times, when they're doing other things, they'll be reciting mantras as well.
And some people, one time I was on a plane with a man from Greece who had never flown on a plane before. And he was so anxious. He had big amber beads. And he was he was just using those beads as kind of a prayer, protective prayer or something, you know.
He was a man from Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if this is true of him, but the Greek Orthodox Church, just like the Catholic Church, he just uses prayer beads. And it's interesting, a lot of people do call them worry beads. Mm-hmm. So when you're feeling worried, you do your worry beads.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Comforting can be.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question about the self that, or the non-self that is aware. And it's difficult for me to think of a no self when it feels like there's something that's aware of what's happening or that's making decisions or that's, you know, I'm just confused about that.
Oh, well, I mean, there is something that's aware. I mean, that body and mind right now is aware, right? But it's the idea that there's somehow something other than that heap of atoms and molecules and that bit of mental energy that's taking place, that this awareness resides in. You see, that's what our mind tends to want to posit, that there's something other than what we are. And so the Buddha said, you know, that this is the real self, is the five aggregates. That is the self. There's no self besides. So the single, permanent, eternal, reincarnated, this is the self that he said that when you look, you'll find none of that there. But yeah, something's aware. You're aware. Okay. I mean, you exist. It's just that you don't exist in the way your mind imagines that you might.
Okay.
And you are aware. Something's aware. Awareness, you put it this way, awareness is happening. It's the whole problem is you really can't you speak the way we normally do and make sense of this. If I say, well, you are aware, in that word you is the seed of the very idea that we're trying to become unattached from. I say, I am aware, or it's awareness is happening. This five aggregates, this manifestation of isness has this unique property of awareness, as do all kinds of other manifestations of isness, lizards and beetles and the birds and everything else have awareness. Not only does awareness manifest there, but something else manifests as well that we would call consciousness. And this is where our attachment really gets strong, is that, well, not only is this body aware of things and responding to it, but there is this subjective experience of being conscious of that awareness.
Yeah, that's what's kind of...
Excuse me.
Welcome, Nama.
Sorry,
and so you can ask your question over again and say, okay, well, ask your question over again in terms of consciousness instead of awareness. Why do these five aggregates have this subjective experience of knowing things? What's happening there? What is that?
Well, I know we're struggling to not see everything is out there, And still, it appears to be out there. I mean, this is, you know, the same thing, that because we're not enlightened, we are in the subject-object situation, where we're the subject and there's the object.
Yeah.
And even when I say I am doing something, I see myself as a subject doing something out there. So that's the thing you know, I keep asking you, I mean, I keep talking about this over and over again, because it's a difficult concept.
That's right. It is difficult. And it's even more difficult because we sometimes pick up ideas along the way that are misleading, and we have to set aside our misleading ideas. So this that I'm experiencing and that you're experiencing right now is an appearance in your mind. The particular kind of object that you perceive this as doesn't exist except in your mind. Your mind has made it up to account for the sensory experience that's happening. And an interesting thing about this is that we can go a step further and say, well, okay, it may only appear to be the kind of thing I think it is, but it's still a thing of some kind, isn't it? And the answer is that, well, no. Buddhist logicians back in the medieval times realized that there really can't be any such thing as things. And modern physicists and modern Western philosophers have also come to the same conclusion, that thingness is a reflection of the way our mind works. All that there is process, and our mind takes the process and creates thingness. Okay? Now, so if we recognize that, well, something's happening there, my mind makes it look like a thing, but it's really a process, it's not a thing. And my mind causes it to be a particular kind of thing with a particular nature, because that's the way my mind works. But if it's not even a thing, it's not even a process that has that particular nature, because these are all things that my mind is projecting onto this experience. And then that allows us to realize that you aren't experiencing this thing as a thing in the same way. You're experiencing it as a thing, just like I am, but you're not experiencing it the same way that I am. To you, it's a different kind of thing, because your mind can only project it based on your mind's cumulative experience and the way your mind works. And my mind does the same thing in a different way, a slightly different way, and everybody else's does it. So this sort of opens us up to realizing that this thing, the way I perceive it, only exists in my mind. And it will take some different form in anybody else's mind. And because we're both humans, and because our minds are similar, we can talk about it, and we may come to believe that we see, experience it in the same way. But the truth is that we don't really. Now, where you can get off track is that some people will say, oh, well, that exists only in your mind, which means it doesn't exist at all. And that's wrong. You know, your sensory experience of this happened, and it happened as a result of causes. So there's a cause for the experience that caused your mind to perceive a particular kind of thing in a particular way. And so you can drive yourself crazy if you hear people say, well, emptiness means that nothing exists. And that's nonsense. And no self means that you don't exist. And you keep saying, I don't exist. Why do I feel? I feel like I exist. You know, you'll drive yourself crazy because it's nonsense. Because it's nonsense. Suchness is the word that is used in the scriptures to describe what is. Suchness, isness, that is empty of all the things that our mind projects upon it. That's empty of the things that the stories that our mind makes up about it. That's what it's empty of. And so we can call suchness emptiness. But what we have to realize is it's the appearances generated by our mind that don't exist. We're not saying that suchness doesn't exist. Does that make it a little bit easier to... I mean, your mind says, now can say, all right, I can work with this. The idea that nothing existed just kept taking me someplace where it was a dead end. I can't go any further. The same thing's true with, okay, I feel like I'm a self, an individual self, and I experience myself in this way. And here's somebody telling me I don't exist. So if I don't exist, who's having the experience? If I don't exist, then this awareness can't be happening. But it seems to be happening. And how can, to whom can it seem to be, even if it's not happening, to whom can it seem to be happening? You see, it's a nonsense cycle. The point of this, what the Buddha was teaching, is you are not the self that you are naturally inclined to believe that you are. That's as much an illusion as thinking that this aspect of suchness is whatever your mind projects it to be. Yes?
Can I just ask you a question about what you just said, the same kind of lessons?
Sure.
That we're not who we naturally believe ourselves to be?
Yeah.
So is it who we naturally believe ourselves to be or who we are conditioned to believe we are?
Well, it's both. It's naturally, though. We have inherited, since a history of life on this planet, biology has deliberately made organisms imagine themselves to be a separate kind of self, because this is how nature works. So naturally, we could not begin otherwise, because being what we are internally designed, programmed, constructed in such a way that we cannot perceive in any other way other than this particular kind. We perceive ourselves as a who, and there is no who. But it's an illusion that this mass of matter creates, because it allows this mass of matter to behave in a particular way. Basically, if this mass of matter thinks it's a self, this mass of matter is going to, by being itself, means it is separate from everything else. And so now this mass of matter is going to go around behaving in a way that finds ways to benefit itself at the expense of other, so that it can survive. And it has instincts to reproduce itself. This mass of matter comes, as you know, with this instinct to do the things that cause reproduction. And so, because it thinks of itself as itself, and because it thinks of its pleasures and its pains as real, this mass of matter behaves as though it's a who that wants things and doesn't like other things, and it perpetuates itself. The result is there's a whole lot of other masses of matter that come from one like this, because this mass of matter behaves in that way. This is nature. And it's built into us. We came into existence as a result of this process. And that whole process succeeded because it inherently perceives itself as a separate entity from everything else. If it didn't, it wouldn't behave in those ways. So So this illusion of self, in that sense, is a good thing, because it's brought us to where we are. And even the desire and aversion and all the cravings that it gives rise to is a good thing, because it's this beautiful world is the result of it. Both the different forms suchness takes in terms of birds and lizards and everything else, and ourselves, and the mind that takes in what tiny little bit of suchness it can and generates the beautiful world that it experienced. All of that is a result of this. So the illusion of self is an illusion, but it's not a bad thing. And the compulsions of craving, desire, and aversion are not bad things in themselves. But the point is, as a kind of being, we suffer uniquely. We suffer uniquely compared to other beings who are not as conscious as we are. And more importantly, we're at a stage where we can take a step beyond the biological evolution of a mass of matter. We don't need to be trapped within the illusion of self and the compulsions, the innate instinctive compulsions that drive us, that we can experience truth. And through the experience of the truth, we can shed the illusions that have served this wonderful purpose for so long. And by shedding those illusions, we can overcome the innate compulsions that this mass of matter came into being with. And we can achieve a state of happiness and love and compassion and freedom from the kinds of suffering that come from being what we inherently are. See? That's an important thing to, it's a wonderful thing that we can do. You know, a deer doesn't have the ability that we have to take this next step in spiritual evolution. A deer has lots of awareness. You watch a deer, it has a huge amount of awareness, probably more than most of us do. But it doesn't have the amount of consciousness that we do. That there's not as much of that awareness being illuminated by this clear light of consciousness. We have this gift of being much more highly conscious than the birds and the lizards and the deer. And so we have a possibility that they don't. Their gift is that there are a lot of the kinds of suffering that we experience that they are not prone to. But what they unfortunately don't have is the ability to go completely beyond all forms of suffering. So we're very fortunate, we're very blessed to be human beings and to have this capacity. But where we're trying to get to is to recognize in a really, really deep and profound way that we are not what we imagine ourselves to be. We are not separate. We are a part of a wholeness that goes beyond what are limited, what the mind generated by this little pile of matter is capable of grasping. That's our true nature, is that we are a part of a whole, not a separate piece. And so the self we need to discover is that, I am not this separate self. There is no permanent abiding thing that is me apart from everything else, which isn't to say that this mass that there isn't a part of suchness that my mind perceives as a body, because there most definitely is a part of suchness that this mind, which is a part of suchness, perceives as a body, and this mind, which is a part of suchness, perceives itself as a mind, and it perceives itself as separate. But it's not. So that's what we're trying to get to. That's the no self. When the self is gone, there is the unity with what is. And the body and the experience of the body are still realities. The experience of the body in the way we experience it, just like the experience of this in the way we experience it, is not ultimately real. Because with my limited senses and my limited brain and my limited mind, I'm not capable of knowing this as it really is. And I'm not capable of knowing this as it really is. But relative to what my mind is capable of, this is real and that's real. It's just they're not ultimately real. And so that's the answer to your question. There is no who that's experiencing it, but the experience is real. And it is the relative form of an absolute reality.
I've gone over this a million times. And the part that I don't understand is suchness.
Well,
I mean, I know what suchness, as I understand it, is to come to a place, which happens once in a while, of feeling completely awake and completely connected with something that appears to be out there, but I just feel like it's all one. Mm-hmm. And but I don't understand what the suchness is. It seems like suchness is more an experience than a stuff. I don't know what the stuff is that can be created with.
Well, the way your mind is constructed, your mind can only think in terms of stuff. And so your mind needs to make suchness into stuff. And you can let it as long as you also make sure that your mind realizes that it's not really stuff, it's just the only way your mind can think of it.
So do you think that someday we'll be able to look at each other in here and just see some little suchness moving around and that doesn't have any shape or form or color or anything? It just everything in here is just little vibrating or moving particles.
We can, although there's not much point in that except as helping us to let go of our illusions. Far better to be able to look around and see that this is all suchness with its color and its form and its shape, which is actually suchness generated by suchness. So this part of suchness has this perception of you with your color and your shape and your smile and all these other characteristics that suchness is capable of projecting onto suchness. So far better, I mean, it's good to go through the phase of seeing all of this dissolve so that I know that it's not ultimately real. But one of the most beautiful things about the fact that we are is that our minds do create this. So why not enjoy it? Why would I, if I can know everyone and everything here as the suchness that it is, and still enjoy the color and the form and the variety and everything else that is also within the nature of suchness, that's even better, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and that's the meaning of a Buddha's mind dwells in nirvana, that's knowing the suchness, while the body and the mind are in the marketplace. So, you know.
So we're really existing in two dimensions at the same time and can just go back and forth.
It doesn't have to. Initially, you go back and forth, but we're moving where in the going back and forth, we're getting to the place where we don't have to go back and forth. We can see that there really isn't two things to go back and forth between, that they are both genuinely present at the same time.
Traveling through suchness. I don't know if you don't mind me saying.
No, I don't. Please, please,
it's
please.
It's separate. It's, to me, it's another experience. I don't think of those things as separate. It's more like.
You don't think of it as.
Separate.
A separate, yeah.
Place in this place.
That's the whole.
It's more like, thing, oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Although it's very compelling and. I might want more and more of that because it's so cool, but I don't like to think of it as separate.
And that's the whole point. It isn't. Suchness has, there is no separateness within suchness. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing outside of suchness.
Can I say one more thing?
Sure, yeah.
Is all the work that we all do to... Because of all that cool stuff, I don't know. To me, it starts getting in the way. For me, anyway, it just starts getting in. Not the work, and you do the work. I don't even like to call it work. Do meditations and enjoy each other's company and food and sun and stuff. I don't know what I'm saying.
So
I forget.
So you're saying, just enjoy life, and know that everything you see, everything you think is something is not what you think it is.
I think relax. For me, relaxing into life makes all the other cool stuff more available. I don't get in my own way so much, looking for. I really like answers. Believe me, I like answers, but all that, for me, I'm a lot more peaceful if I don't look, I guess is what I want to say. In Not that I'm totally at peace all the time, and I mean, I still suffer. I still suffer.
Well, for some people, maybe... I have to keep searching, looking, asking. And I hear this, you know, I go over the same things over and over again to remind myself.
It's like a koan. You keep going over things. It's sooner or later, your mind's going to just have enough of it and let go of it.
And that happens too.
But does it seem to me like that we're trying to understand something that really can't be understood? So it's like, oh, let's try to understand this. Well, that's impossible. Is that right, John?
Yeah. And another way to think about it, a little shift. I mean, we've been talking about suchness, and we talk about suchness, it sounds like stuff. But we say everything the same way. Instead of suchness, we call it consciousness or clear light of mind. And consciousness keeps taking objects, and the objects that consciousness takes are all things generated by the mind. They're not things that exist of themselves from their own side. And so every time consciousness takes an object, it keeps consciousness from knowing itself. So we're trying to get the place of realizing that all there really is consciousness, and when consciousness knows itself, then there can be no separation. You know, if we think of suchness as stuff, then we can divide stuff. But if consciousness knows itself, there's no place to divide. Consciousness taking itself as its object. And the one advantage of talking about it in that way is it's very close to the kind of experience that people have, which is their mind stops generating appearances. And if they don't lose consciousness, if they remain conscious when the mind stops generating appearances, then consciousness knows itself. And that's the way the experience is most likely to be interpreted after it happens is, well, my mind stopped and there was just pure consciousness. And that consciousness is truth, reality, God consciousness, or, you know, there's different words that we put on it based on, you know, God consciousness is a good one if we're thinking of it in terms of consciousness or universal consciousness, because, those kinds of terms help the conceptual mind to not fall into certain mistaken ways of conceptualizing.
It all works really fine until you feel like something terrible is happening to your body.
Yeah. Well, and that's...
And then, you know, that's when this really can help, I think, to realize this. Mm-hmm. Your body is just going through these processes.
Yeah.
But the mind, you know, the mind wants to protect the body, take care of whatever this is happening. If you've broken your leg or your heart is pounding rapidly and you think you're going to have a heart attack or you have asthma and you can't get your breath, then, you know, you forget the whole thing and you're just like, take care of me, you know, I don't want to die. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's partly training yourself to when you get into kind of a panicky situation of some kind that you can come back to these understandings, right?
That is helpful, yeah. You see, the mind exists to take care of the body. That's its whole purpose. That's why it was created, right? And as you say, you can think, well, I understand this. This is all great. Until the body starts to die, until there's a pain in the chest, you know, or till, you know. And then the thing is that's the problem that with intellectual understanding. And don't misunderstand what I mean by intellectual understanding. I don't mean a bunch of fancy philosophical arguments. I mean a kind of understanding that's taking place in the conceptual mind. No matter what a perfect picture your conceptual mind generates, no matter how much you say to yourself, oh, I really understand it, if it's being understood by the conceptual mind, it will disappear, that understanding will disappear in an instant when the raw nature of mind is confronted with the raw reality of the body and the mind's own existence being threatened. It lets go of all that beautiful conceptual picture and you're left right back in the place you were. So the liberation comes when that knowledge is at a much more profound level, so that it's, you know, when it's not conceptual, then you don't lose it so easily. And that is the obstacle, too, is that your mind can create such a pretty picture of understanding that it's really hard to let go of that and to take your understanding to the next level. And the same thing, you know, I want to be awakened. I want to be enlightened. Well, no I can ever be awakened, because to be awakened is to be no I. And as long as there's an I wishing to be this, to become this, no matter how perfect your practice has been in every other way, it's that last barrier, and as long as it's there, you know, as long as there's some I, some me, some who, somebody that's wanting something, you know, it's not going to happen. The same thing, so long as you still cling to a conceptual understanding of all these truths and expressed in so many different ways in poetry and other things like that, it's still conceptual. And as long as you cling to that, when you get down to the nitty gritty of it, you're going to still have that same experience. But you got to get beyond it. And that's really, in a sense, what all this is about. You can even skip all the intellectual understanding. Since you have to get rid of all the intellectual understanding to reach true understanding, it is possible to skip that entirely. But when you've got the intellectual understanding, it's hard to give it up, too.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome.
Good to see you.
And that's why the other way that the attachment to self goes can be through surrender. It needn't go through the stage of recognizing that self is empty and that perceptions are empty and things like that. Through surrender, giving up. You know, a being that totally believes in the reality of their self, their soul, but who comes to the point of absolutely genuinely being willing to give that up and to surrender that, they'll arrive at the same place. So the good news is you're already where you're trying to get.
Good place to walk in on.
You just don't know you're there, that's all. Or you forget. Or you have experiences. I think maybe this is what's happening with you. You have experiences every now and then, both in and out of meditation, where you do know where you are, but they don't last very long, and the mind that has the view of self that wants to be awakened immediately comes in and says, "Oh wow, me, I want that. Good, look. And then it's all gone until the next time it happens. So you just keep doing it over and over again. So it wouldn't be practical to try to recap this conversation.
I'm really sorry.
Oh, don't you be sorry. I'm sorry. Just that, you know. It's recorded. I'll put it up on my website.
Thank you.
Well, she's already heard it a million times.
But I need it a million times more, wouldn't I?
Yeah, that's the way I feel. Over and over the same.
You do, and it's because we keep attaching to ideas that lead us down wrong
paths. Stop reading all books. Stop, you know, just be and be in enjoyment and understand, because I do, from these years of things, understand that what I see is not what it is.
Yeah.
What I hear is not what is. What I think, everything is something else. So, taking responsibility for my own creations, just being happy, being joyful, being sad, being whatever, being lonely, being scared, just being whatever the being is, whatever the process is, whatever's happening, just okay, that's what's happening, it's going to change.
It's being with the maximum amount of consciousness that you can bring to
being. To know.
That's the essential part
of it. To know that this is change.
Yeah. I've had an experience for many years teaching physiology to undergraduates. That there would be something that was clearly explained in the textbook, and I would explain it in the classroom. And then people would come for tutorial sessions afterwards and say, I tried, I can't understand this. It's just, no matter how hard I try, I can't get it. And after a little while, I learned, and I got to be really good at helping students because I knew what was always the problem is that they had some idea that was incorrect, that they were trying to understand this with some piece of information that was backward or in one way or another. You know, they had all of the different pieces of information here, and every time they tried to put it together, it wouldn't fit or it would fall apart. And so what I would do with them is try to find, okay, what's the wrong idea that this person is holding? Let's go through all the pieces. Let's find the one that is wrong, and we'll make it right, and then they'll be able to understand. And then they did. And then they go, oh yeah, well, now all the time I was thinking that, yeah.
And he did that with me. I was in calculus, and he was trying to help me understand calculus, and he had to take me back to the third grade math. I was like, oh, quite funny.
But I'm finding the same thing with teaching the Dharma, is that it's because we get some idea, we get some notion that we're so sure that we understand that piece correct. We got that idea right. And then we try to put it all together, and it keeps not coming together. You have to go back, and you have to find where the mistaken idea is. You said something about quit reading the books. The problem is not all, but most of the books you will read are written by somebody who hasn't quite been able to get it all together. And it's because they have some ideas that are wrong. And so you can read an awful lot of books and not find your wrong ideas or even get new wrong ideas to get in your way. The real advantage of reading books and listening to teachings and things like that can be to figure out where what idea you might have wrong or backwards or so forth.
The ancient texts are still the kind that I like to read.
They're really good. But the thing is, that's where a lot of the wrong ideas come from. Because the ancient texts are written for a people that lived perhaps thousands of years ago in a very different culture, with a very different kind of knowledge base that they grew up in. And not only that, the words and phrases that were used in those days had special meanings and connotations, just like the words and phrases we use today do, that we are not necessarily aware of. Imagine somebody in the 25th century reading something written in the modern young person's vernacular about, this is what you need, this is really bad. Back then they believed they need to have bad things. and you could be puzzled forever by that because you don't know that bad means good in that particular vernacular. So It's really good to read the ancient things because at least you spare yourself a lot of the overlay of misunderstanding by people that have come later. But the downside is that, well, you're still getting an overlay because unless you can read it in the original language it was written in, you're still depending on somebody else's translation. But not only that, most of the stuff, the ancient stuff that's come down to us, has also been reworked and rewritten by people who didn't necessarily understand it perfectly. So it's difficult to find a totally reliable source. And then it's difficult, even if we find a totally reliable source, to know that we can reliably and accurately interpret it. But that's all fine. That's quite all right, since all the answers are in here anyway. And all of the practice is about getting your mind to the place where you can see the answers. And then when you can see the answers, you can go and read the book and say, oh, I got that one wrong. Oh, I got that one right. That's why when we were talking earlier, I was just trying to point out to you that, you know, you've heard people say, well, emptiness means that nothing exists. Well, that's not true. And if you think that, you'll never understand the truth. And likewise, there is no self, not the kind of separate self that we naturally think we are, because that's what our biology wants us to think so that we'll behave the way we do. But, you know, I wanted to emphasize for you that you're not trying to discover that you don't exist, because the you that you think you are doesn't exist, but something exists for sure.
Well, how about just saying a prayer that I want to be, or please help me surrender to the will of the universe. Please help me see, help me in all, everything I do to be in harmony with not my egotistical will, but the will of whatever the larger is. That's sort of the conclusion that I've come to.
That's the path of surrender. You bring your sense of a self up as strong as you can. Oh, I feel like I am this real wanting, suffering self, and make it as real as possible, and then surrender that. Not my will, but thine be done. If it be the will of Allah, I give myself totally, take me, do with me as you wish. If you do that, you can't hold anything back.
That's my conclusion from all of it.
Yeah, well, that's a path. That's a very valid path. And it's a do that. And make your sense of self as clear and real as you possibly can, because you want to give the whole thing up to that which is higher. So you don't want to hold anything back. And it is in the moment before the giving is complete, it is very painful. It is the experience of the death of the self. Because if you give yourself and your will totally to something higher, totally, then it's as if you die.
Big work.
Has this discussion been of interest or helpful to the rest of you? Well, why don't we take a little break? You might, well, you don't need to so much. Everyone else has been sitting here. So stretch your legs a little bit and come back in about, if you need to use the washroom, you can. And in about 10 minutes, we'll begin our meditation. Okay.